I think that's a fair critique. I do. And you know, I joined this group that when I looked at all the problem statements that we were facing, I thought this was the hardest one, the most, and also the one that puts our society right now at most risk, not only here but around the world. The growth of authoritarianism and all of these other political trends are rooted in the streams of misinformation that so many of our fellow citizens have been influenced by and that caused them to action. And the question is the one that you just put your finger on perfectly, which is what role does the open education and open access movements potentially have to play in addressing that crisis? And I don't know that in our 90 minutes together we develop solutions, but I think our shared sense was that we have to step up to that plate. We have to be part of addressing the disinformation. Because we're in the information and education business, we have to be part of addressing the disinformation that's polluting our public discourse and destroying our most valuable institutions. And Peter's thought is maybe one way to begin is with a convening that would do a deeper dive into trying to figure out what we could bring to the table to address those problems. But I think that drawing the bridge between the two spheres is not readily apparent to anybody, certainly not me.
I think it's critically important. There are lots of things we can or should be doing. I just don't know how many of them are also open education things.
Right. Yeah. Nor do I. But that's a question I'd sure love to have properly resourced to try and figure out if we could find out what we could contribute in that realm. It would be of enormous consequence nationally and internationally.
So I have a quick comment. I think I know what the concentric circles are, and I'll try that out, and then I'm going to critique it. So to me, it's like the Sunlight Foundation, right? The reason that open makes sense around truth is that open is open. You can investigate the data. I can see where you did the research. I can look at your data sets. I can see the history of the way this educational resource was produced. Because as you adapt it from version to version, you're legally required in the attribution statement to show the provenance of the work, and we could be even better with that with databases. So, I get the connection. I'm cautious about extending our charge out to truth for the reasons that MJ said, and I think it would be confusing to most educators if we were in there advocating for open access or open education or open data or whatever we're talking about, and we start to talk to them about what's truth and what's not. It's a big ask. I mean, it's been a big ask for this group to think about it and try to make those connections. My sense is that it might push a lot of potential adopters and advocates and people that want to join the field out of the conversation if we push that far too fast.
There's another angle to truth participation, increased participation. So the more that we can think about where we need to go as a country, so again, that's first principles in looking at the declaration, like the challenges faced, so let's look at climate change as an organizing principle around this, the huge amount of work we need to do to address that. So education has a big part of that. There's an argument, I think we have a great argument around in order to get to achieve those goals, to address the enormous challenges ahead, we can't get there by closing off access to knowledge. We can't get there by exorbitant costs for course materials that bar most students or many students from completing a degree and moving on. So we got this huge challenge that open does a lot to getting us to open the doors of our institutions, to allow more voices, more attention, more, instead of like a truth, like more truths coming together that can hopefully add up to a kind of truthiness. I'm misusing that probably. So So thinking about how open really is maybe the only way, right? If we envision, if we can have a shared vision of a future in which we're kind of addressing these significant problems, or kind of tuning our economy in a different direction, that we're massively educating our populace to be able to face these challenges, address these challenges. The tool for that, a crucial tool for that, is openness and sharing, not kind of making the price of admissions really steep, so that you're blocking off a kind of potential kind of folks who are going to solve those problems, who need to solve those problems, the voices that need to contribute to that. So it's not really getting at what you're asking for necessarily.
Well, it is in a way.
But a different angle on maybe a more collective, you know, I've thought about less a declaration of independence, but like if an asteroid were heading to hit the Earth, right, in a couple of days, we have a very short amount of, like that's a moonshot kind of survival thing that you start to forget who's in the White House and what you start to think about. Well, yeah, we all agree that we want to stick around and that we can work, if we work together, we're going to maybe we'll do this. And so the really important stuff tends to rise to the top, right? So openness, it seems to me that if you can articulate, or if we can articulate this communication thing, or maybe it's an educational SDG or something, of something like, let's shake this off a little bit and come, what can we agree on? It doesn't matter if you're conservative or liberal, right? We agree, like, kind of these mechanisms for advancement and solving problems. And then once, if you can do a good job with that, like, open's great, because it's a solution that we've seen work. We bury the message, we bury the lead, you know, like we on this all the time. But here's a thing that works in so many contexts for a little bit of cost, no cost, right? That I think we have a great messaging opportunity for it. But we just don't know where to apply it.
Like how to operationalize. And if I could sort of clarify one of Cable's comments, is just that the reason all of these academic institutions exist is the search for truth. That's why we're not religious organizations. You know, we're not institutions of faith, as important as those are, and I participate in one of those too. But all of these academics, they exist because of a sense that there is a truth, and by proper and sound methods, we can discover it, and we have a truth crisis globally. And so the question is, maybe the way I spoke about it, which you reacted in a way that made you feel like it's a bridge too far, and that it would drive people out of the room. And I trust your instincts. I think if you reacted that way, you're right. I agree with you. Then the question is, you know, how can we recenter truth within the open movement in a way that brings people into the room, that doesn't drive them out. And the minute that you feel driven out of the room, we've gone in the wrong direction.
I think it's a small adjustment. So what Sharon said, I'm very comfortable with, and it's almost exactly the same thing as what you said. But rather than talking about truth, she talked about the value of an education. It doesn't matter what government in the world you talk to, they all understand the basic values of having an educated citizenry. They understand they can't have a diversified economy without that. They understand they won't be competitive on the global stage without that. They understand that people with educations make more money, have easier lives, and more fulfilling, rounded lives than if they're not educated. Like, they get that. I think in that conversation, we could say everything you just said, which is spot on. Like, I agree with everything you said about one of the values of education is that you learn the scientific method and you will be exposed to knowledge that has been vetted in proper ways because the truth matters, right? But the I think all I'm doing is playing with the messaging.
And Cable, you and I have been going back and forth all day. Big, bold statement Cable's talking about, and I've been talking about some of the underlying infrastructure that can nudge people in that direction. You just rattled off a bunch of stuff about, I've openly licensed this, that this means you can interrogate the data, you can do this, you can do that. That was beautiful. But where's the infrastructure that forces my hand around that? I don't know that the paper trail of CC BY licenses necessarily does that. Is there something there? Is there something there around meta tags or something else that could be embedded in these objects that could actually make that apparent so that when I put something out there, I'm being held to a standard? This is a lot like the digital badging conversation right now, where we're trying to demonstrate through the standards, the IMS global standards, that these are rigorously assessed and that there's a whole evaluation plan behind these things. So what we're doing is building into the standard the things that require, you know, that somebody put that information in, or if they haven't put it in there, there's an empty field. So it's clear I haven't put in the assessment plan. I haven't put in all those kinds of things.
It's unverified.
Unverified. So are there things like that, and I don't understand the technologies behind this, but are there things like that technically could be part of this, these materials, that would force people to begin making sure that they've validated things, that there's a paper trail, there's a way to interrogate the data?
Policy, too.
And policy, yeah.
I would love if that existed.
Yeah, I don't know. This is my utopian, you know, craziness.
That's a question for the tools.
Yeah.
Where are the tools people? Build that.
It's a great brilliant comment. Thank you. It's a brilliant comment. And it reminds me just quickly of a conversation I had many years ago with Doug Engelbart. Some of you know who Doug was? Mm-hmm. Doug was he's widely regarded as the inventor of both the computer mouse and the hypertext link. He was the first person. Steve Jobs went to watch him demonstrate how a mouse might work, and he had the first idea for what we call links. And I remember sitting down with Doug one time, and he was explaining, this is pre-browsers, pre-internet, how he thought hypertext would work, linking, what we call linking. And his original vision for it was that when somebody made an assertion of something, a fact, that then you would be able to link it to the proof, or the source, the original source material, so that it would be impossible in the world that Doug envisioned as he was inventing this idea of text documents that could be digitally hyperlinked. His whole use case was that it would be a way to verify facts. And when we think of the way that links are used today, of course, you know, it's like he created a Frankenstein and then got used in all different ways. But the very inventor, or the person who's credited as being the inventor of hypertext links, thought it would be a way to embed factual references in written assertions that would allow people to evaluate the veracity of the assertions that had been made.
That kind of infrastructure, you know, is being built in the scholarly space. And one of the projects in the Knowledge Futures Group, which also gets back to something Sharon said about an institution like MIT saying, you know, leading by example about what we can do, is there is this project that's being led by Danny Hillis, which is essentially an open knowledge graph with provenance information so that you can verify the veracity or at least the source of a But to the more specific point about, you know, meta tags, it's extremely powerful. That's what I mean by the ground, you know, a ground up. I mean, wouldn't it be great, and this is what I see in the scholarly space, if you can separate assessments of quality from the brand of the journal or the brand of the publisher, and so we are building these essentially standards around peer review to sort of say that this has been reviewed, this has been, you know, whether or not you think peer review is the be-all and end-all is another thing, but right, you know, being able to make that discoverable and machine-readable, and you can search on for resources that have been vetted in a particular way. So I think that's key to everything we're talking about.
Yeah, I do.
One of the wrestling matches we've had in the OER career for so long is what is the metadata scheme going to be for the open content? And, you know, we got so far, we got so close, and everybody dug in because they, you know this place.
Standards creation is you have to be, you know, the perfect is the enemy of the good. You have to have a sort of, you know, there's a sweet spot of just a relatively high level of description that's good enough to capture.
Knowing there's going to be a 2.0.
Yeah, exactly.
This is exactly the sort of cross-cutting, you know, across these themes
that I was hoping we would start to get into this afternoon. That the needs of the true conversation lead to things that people who are thinking more about tools should be working on. Are there other things like that might be floating around that we've sort of glanced across in some of these conversations that would be worth holding up as a cross-cutting theme that's jumped out?
What did you just say? I missed what you said.
Sorry, it was a context switch.
Really nice.
Just wondering if there are other examples like that one of, a conversation we've been having about truth, leading to, hey, we need some help from kind of a tools perspective. Are there other things like that that we could hold up as a way to kind of cap off the conversation? Because we're supposed to be done in 15 minutes.
Seems like many of us are talking about messaging or communication in an overarching way that has connected to several of these discussions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Everybody needs.
Well, Kurt, I'll throw one more out, which is that we talked about in our group, which I credit to the best political organizer I've ever known and worked with, and that's my friend Martha Cantor, with whom I served in Washington. And Martha's philosophy, we were just talking yesterday, I spent the last couple of days at her house, and she is arguably responsible for the foundations of our progress in OER in California and helping to sort of order my own work in ways that are, turn me from the bloviating, overly popular person that we saw this morning to actual concrete actions that make a difference. And she embraces something called inquiry-based organizing. And in a nutshell, I wonder if this might be a deliverable. I don't know. It also may be in the Department of Impractical Ideas. But the way she helped get the OER goals off the ground in our community college district, I wonder if something similar could be done nationally. And that would help us form the kind of more diverse coalition that we're looking for. We were trying to start an OER program at the Foothill De Anza Community College District, 1,100 faculty. How are we going to get started? So she began by doing a survey of all of the faculty members. And in the survey, she asked them, are you interested in using public domain? We were calling them public domain learning materials. Are you interested in using public domain learning materials? What's your attitude about them? Did you know? Kind of a bit of it was a little push-pull, informing people about what the opportunities were. And then asking them to respond to the survey. We got back 600 or 700 responses. Maybe 400 people said that they didn't think they weren't interested in this. They didn't think it was any good, whatever. But about 200 people responded with some level of positive interest. And there we had our, and then she called a meeting of those 200 people who had expressed an interest in working on these kinds of issues. And then she asked them, how can we help you? What could we do as a college administration that would help you achieve the goals that you endorsed in your responses to the questionnaire? And that's how the Foothill De Anza Community College District became the first college in the country to start offering open educational resources that were articulated with our course credits. I wonder if there's an opportunity for a group like ours to do or deliver a national survey of faculty that helps us identify whatever percent it is, the 5%, the 3%, the 1%, the 10% of faculty around the country who then we might organize and support in becoming the change agents that we want to see at scale. So the deliverable, the practical deliverable would be some kind of a national survey. And if you decided to do that, I would recommend that you talk to Martha Cantor and ask her how she would draft the survey, because she would be able to figure it out in ways that would be beyond my ability.
Nationally representative or actual?
Well, in our case, we surveyed everybody, because we wanted their names. Yeah, give me your name, give me your email address. Are you interested in collaborating with people in your region? Are you interested in collaborating with people in your institution? And then, boom, we have identified 30 people at the University of Nebraska who maybe never talked to each other before.
And then we pull them together in a meetup. And then we have, you know, we've nationally organized our core supporters all over the country through what Martha calls inquiry-based organizing. Her point to me was always, you know, don't go tell people what you want to do and then expect them to do it. You know, find out from people figure out how to create a coalition of the willing. See if you can identify who the willing partners are. And then once you identify the willing partners are, you can find out how you can support them in achieving their own goals. And
so you may be able to scale that up a little quicker. You know, Mark and I and several others are involved now in a collaboration among statewide OER initiatives. In fact, we've got 10 involved now. I think we're probably soon going to be at about 20 statewide initiatives. You know, you could work with those groups to figure out how to support their efforts to do exactly what you did. And Achieving the Dream would be another good one to pull into that. You know,
yeah.
Finding ways there's your coalition of the willing and the ones that are trying to get this work done. You know, finding ways to support those folks at the level higher, mm-hmm. one step higher might be another take on that same
yeah.
idea.
I mean, we're 15, 20 years into this, and we don't have a national mailing list of OER-friendly, inclined, or interested educators. And gee, it might be good to know who all of our allies are, and to flush out of the woodwork.
You could produce a list of 5 or 10,000 people. Sorry.
You weren't here for his conversation about the social. Oh, no, I just meant the building a list, but how is the list governed? And
okay.
The list governed.
Well, different question. But
I know, your list is governed by you.
Mm-hmm.
But we have, OpenStaff has an email list of thousands and thousands of faculty.
Well, and CCC OER, which Hal, you and Martha founded at Fidel Danza years ago, today has nearly 1,000 community college folks on its list.
But I think we haven't reached most of the faculty in the country.
Oh, I think you're right. I mean,
that's accurate.
And we haven't
they turn over.
We haven't invited them. So we were just talking about what are deliverables? What are practical things we could do? And maybe one practical thing we could do is maybe in the Department of Impractical Ideas, but maybe one actual deliverable is we could do a Martha Cantor style survey that ends up with us or whoever compiling the list that then allows us to organize that community to become even more effective galvanizers of change than happens now in the current sort of chaotic, episodic, you know, organic way that things burble up. Maybe we could actually organize this entire community and invite more people to participate. So that was one thing that came up in our little focus group was maybe a survey is a deliverable.
We should maybe assume that all of them wouldn't want to join the movement too. I mean, we should
sure.
respect that.
Sure. Yeah. We at Foothill Danza, you know, we ended up with 200 people who were interested, and at the end we have, you know, maybe two dozen who actually rolled up their sleeves and did their work.
Right.
But the result was change at scale. It's pretty important.
So, looking ahead to our time tomorrow and where we've come to today, we've got 3 hours together tomorrow. We wanted to wrap up tomorrow by, you know, drawing out where we're at and talking about our objectives for meeting number 3. But we've got kind of, 2 hours and change perhaps to continue some of the conversations in our teams, but also gather together on a few of these cross-cutting themes. So I heard truth needs tool support. We've got the survey. We've got the messaging. SDG-style first principles thing is maybe 3 other work streams that we might want to collect about tomorrow. How should we go about this?
Notes. Yeah. Well, just that we had a conversation in our breakout group about
this group at some point is going to have to make a choice about whether or not they're going to produce these SDG-like first principle docs and sort of throw them out there and then do this, which is fine. Like, that's a contribution to the community, and people could do with it what they will, and we've served our purpose. That's one route we could take. Another route we could take would be to put out these first principle documents about where we want to go, and then this group and others in our networks who are also leaders in the open fields would or could sign up to lead persistent campaigns around each of those big ideas, and there would be a conversation about collaboration and cooperation and eliminating some redundancies so that we can be as efficient as possible. We would lay out what the steps looked like for each one of those because they're long and they're significant and they're going to take a lot of effort and resources. There'd be a conversation with foundations about here's what we've agreed to do as large parts of the open movement and are you interested in funding along any of these lines? And we ultimately could have similar conversations with governments, right, about this is what winning looks like in various areas of open, and this is where we need your support and attention.
Which one of those two pathways do you favor?
I favor the latter. It's significantly more work and, frankly, would require whole institutions to dedicate at least a few years into the future to focus on particular areas. It's a big ask. And to be totally honest, collaborating and cooperating is just more work. It doesn't matter how friendly you are with other people. It's harder.
Are we getting back together at our groups tomorrow? Isn't that part of the agenda?
Yeah, that was part of the agenda. And what I was wondering is if it makes sense to actually spin off a few of these other things as specific topics.
I almost wish we would have talked more about metadata during our session because, you know, the more we're talking about it, I'm like, you know, that's just so fundamental.
Maybe this can be a dinner group.
Yeah.
I'd love to talk about metadata.
I mean, who wouldn't?
Oh,
all over the car.
Norman's all over it.
Yeah.
Always about metadata. But that would be an amazing project to actually significant funding. Exactly.
I think that's part of the scaffolding.
Right.
And it can facilitate conversations around reward structures for faculty because now we have data that we can access to talk about the kinds of impacts that their OERs are having.
Yeah.
Huge.
Start looking at transfer articulation agreements
yeah,
as being like.
We go there.
Yeah, but really, couldn't you? Yeah. That would be amazing.
Are we talking about really sort of trying to develop a menu of funding opportunities? Here's a list of things that these groups could do, or that our groups could do.
Well, I don't know maybe it's not a menu of funding, right? So there's an organization in K-12, they're called 100K10. I'm sure you've probably read them. But what they've done is, their whole thing is how do we get 100,000 STEM teachers in the United States, or like training, and they've approached it from a grand challenges perspective. So they did a lot of sort of landscape research. Their methodology is actually incredibly interesting, but what they came up with was like a set of like, I think there's 7 grand challenges to their goal, which is having highly trained, highly skilled teaching workforce in STEM education, right? And so the way that they put it on there, you can join a challenge because like the challenges are well articulated. There's a little white paper and some resources. You can say, I also have this challenge, right? And so maybe it's like a combination of what you said and what Table said about part two is like, you know, there are these things that we put into the universe and we give them as opportunities for people to participate in them. So not just funding, but like, well, I would also like to do a thing to solve this problem.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about solve for a second? And how we're certain the relationship between solve and open learning is kind of interesting.
Yes. Except that I was speaking with Kurt about the day tomorrow, and so I missed part of it.
Grand challenges and creating solutions opportunities for the public around these issues. So
yeah.
We have an incentive type solutions effort at MIT called Solve, and there's a lot of active conversation now between open learning and Solve about collaborating.
Yeah, better we can harness sort of fundamental useful knowledge for the teams that are working on these challenges and get them to flow together, so much the better.
What we do have to avoid, though, in light of what you said, Cable, is like a sense that any deliverables that we sign on to somehow paralyze any members of the group because they're too large. So that's like clearly the case. Like it might be the case that the ambition that you speak of is the right ambition, and maybe somewhere between path one and path two is this what fits. I'm not sure what it is, but it, you know, if you're right that it's a multi-year effort that's entirely volunteer or something like that, it might be very difficult for everybody to sign on to it. So my hope is that tomorrow we could somehow scale whatever it is our ambitions are, whatever our deliverables are, and there must be now like 40 of them. You know, it's really remarkable. That's the good news. It's a new month tomorrow. It's a new year. It's a thing. We should do what? Meet at 9?
Yeah. I think let's gather here at 9, and we'll plot a course.
Yeah.
In the morning. Let the dust settle here a little bit. Chat over dinner.
Let the crab cakes settle.
Where's dinner?
Next door.
In the hotel?
And it's
no, literally the next room over. Yeah. And at 7, but there's drinks.
Starting at 7.
And breakfast here in the morning, too.
Breakfast here in this room?
Yeah. Outside. Like it was.
Okay. Wonderful. Great.
Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Everybody, once again, showing up.
Yeah.
Having great conversations.
Oh, man. Pat Jones, or sometimes your friends don't do that.